Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us today. Thomas Woods, Jr. is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. Woods has a bachelor's degree in history from Harvard and a master's and PhD from Columbia University. He's written several other books, including How the Catholic Church Built Western Civilization, as well as innumerable essays. He's an editor with the American Conservative magazine. He's won the Templeton Enterprise Award, the O.P. Alford III Prize for Libertarian Scholarship, and an Olive W. Garvey Fellowship from the Independent Institute. He's currently a fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Alabama. His latest book is 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask. And again, we thank Thomas Woods for joining with us on the telephone today. Thanks so much for joining in.
My pleasure, Jim, and I'm happy to say you're the first radio host who's ever correctly pronounced Ludwig von Mises Institute, so thank you very much.
That was just lucky on my part, I'm sure. You live in Auburn, Alabama?
Yes, sir, I do.
And have written this provocative book, 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask. I would say it's a provocative title designed to get people to react.
Well, yes, I think so. But the reason for that isn't, you know, I'm not trying to stir up controversy for its own sake. I mean, I don't consider myself to belong to the Ann Coulter school of political discourse. My issue here is that I think both in the historical profession and in the mainstream media, what typically happens is that we're presented with false choices. So should we bomb this country or should we bomb this country? And the idea that maybe we shouldn't bomb any country is usually left off the table, that sort of thing. Or the New York Times will say, well, gee, should the top income tax rate be 38.3% or 37.1%? I don't see these as being disputes of great magnitude, you know, whereas what I'm trying in effect to do is to make it possible for us to put back onto the table possibilities that I think the narrowness of our political discourse has artificially excluded.
What do you think are the most leading myths taught in today's history classrooms?
Well, I think one of them involves the concept of states' rights, because, you know, we all know that the idea of states' rights has been obviously in American history employed for, quite grotesque ends, to be sure. But I think what has happened is that the very idea of states' rights has become so toxic in the minds of people that even today, when you raise it innocuously in situations that have nothing to do with race, for instance, you're still sort of viewed as being a little bit odd. And so I'm sympathetic, for instance, to the poor woman Angel Raich out in California, who, as you may know, had a run-in with the law because she's using medical marijuana under that state's law that says you can use it. And she has so many things wrong with her that, I mean, I can't even list them all. It's unbelievable how many things are wrong with her. If she does not use medical marijuana, she has a mysterious wasting disorder that causes her to lose 1 to 2 pounds every day. So she's got all these different problems. She's got tumors. She's got this and that. And so she's been using this treatment. And it seemed as if, surely, under the original Constitution, a state could permit somebody to use this type of treatment. But the federal government declared that no, it has the right to overrule the states on this and to prohibit medical marijuana. And it's interesting to note that the justices, I would argue, would be the most liberal in the American sense, Stephen Breyer and Justice Ginsburg, both upheld and supported the federal government's position against this poor woman. And the one person, not Scalia, but the one person who stood up and said, this is a ridiculous decision, and it obviously violates the understanding of local self-government that's at the heart of our system, was Clarence Thomas. So I think sometimes sometimes artificial left-right distinction is also not helpful.
You pose the question number 4 of your 33 questions, were states' rights just code words for slavery and oppression? And is that true or is that not true?
It's not true. I mean, it is the case, as I said, that states' rights have been put obviously again to undesirable ends. But I think the full story of states' rights in America is so rarely told that people, of course, only hear the grotesque part. They don't hear the part, for instance, my chapter on the states' rights, I think, is including information that in 7 years of teaching history to college students in New York, I never saw even one textbook cite the information I cite. I give, for example, I explain that Daniel Webster, who was the great senator from Massachusetts in the 19th century, Webster, in fact, went so far as to suggest that if during the War of 1812 the federal government should attempt to carry out military conscription, he said the only conceivable outcome on the part of a free people should be that we in the states should, on states' rights grounds, refuse to obey. Our states should simply nullify this declaration by the federal government. And I show many other cases in which war and injustice were attempted to be thwarted by the states using states' rights arguments. And then perhaps the most familiar argument that I cite, although still not familiar enough, is to point out that although the Constitution does have the unfortunate clause that runaway slaves are to be returned to their masters, even that does not mean the federal government could do absolutely anything to return runaway slaves. And I remind people that the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act, believe it or not, actually said that federal slave commissioners before whom accused fugitives are brought, well, they get $10 if they return the fugitive to slavery, and they get only $5 if they free the accused fugitive. Well, this is obviously an injustice if the judge has a financial stake in the outcome of the case. And so for a variety of reasons, northern states argued that this was an unconstitutional law, even though it appealed to a constitutional clause, and a variety of them refused to enforce it. And very interestingly, Wisconsin, I mentioned not at random, Wisconsin's Supreme Court in 1859, when trying to justify that state's behavior and refusing to obey this law or making it very difficult for the federal government to enforce it, they cited a 60-year-old argument by Thomas Jefferson, arguing that the states should not be compelled to enforce unconstitutional laws. Now, this is a chapter in our national life, and I think now, in particular, people who sometimes associate themselves with the left need to understand it's not Birmingham 1963 anymore. And sometimes the federal government is doing things you don't like, and maybe it's worth reconsidering the possibility of states' rights once again.
Our guest is Thomas Woods. That's one of the questions that he poses in his book, 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask. And you can get more information about Thomas Woods' thoughts and writings at his website, which is thomasewoods.com. thomasewoods.com, T-H-O-M-A-S. As we continue, we invite you to join the conversation with your own thoughts and questions. In Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free call. You lead off your questions, number one, with did the Founding Fathers support immigration? Initially, you would imagine, I would think, that they would, since they were immigrants themselves.
Well, the position they took was sort of a nuanced one. And I raise it because, you know, here we've just had this national discussion of immigration, and you would think just out of curiosity that somebody might have said, well, you know what, I wonder what the Founding Fathers thought. Not that that would answer the debate, but it'd just be interesting to know. And what I'm showing is that they basically took sort of what they would consider to be a common sense position, that they would not say that all immigration is to be excluded. Their view was that you have to proceed, nevertheless, with a certain caution, because as Jefferson suggested, he said, imagine what would happen if we had a million people from France, which at the time he was writing was still an absolute monarchy, and all of a sudden a million people who have been raised on absolute monarchy settle in the middle of our young country. He said, would that create more confusion, or would that be a good thing? And he thinks it would create more confusion. It would disrupt our political system. And likewise, he said, I perfectly understand why if a million liberty-loving Americans plomp down in the middle of Paris, that would annoy the French government. He said, I understand that perfectly. He said his concern was that a lot of times people coming to America would be coming from places where they might not have had experience living in a free society, they might be unacquainted with the principles of on which our government is based, and that the result could be difficult for us. So I think their advice was simply to use common sense.
Our guest is Thomas Woods, Jr., and his book is 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask. The lines are full at the moment, so we better start clearing some of them. And let's go to Mary in Madison first. Hello, Mary. What's on your mind today?
Hello. Yes, I know with the Patriot Act, and I guess it's the Fourth Amendment, and it seems like they just ignore what we've inherited from the British about, you know, our rights. And I was just wondering, I've got a sketchy idea from my high school freshman class about the Magna Carta, and I know one of the rights was secure in your home. And I was wondering, could you just review that for me in non-Latin terms?
Sure. Sure. And I appreciate the caller's question, because I perfectly agree. You know, even though I think of myself as being somebody on the right, I think I'm as appalled as anybody by what's been going on in the current administration. And it's interesting, there are some libertarians and the occasional maverick Republican congressman who are also opposed to it. But, yeah, what we're it seems to me that in the name of waging the war on terror, we are seeing a kind of an assault that's building steam on what are very ancient British rights that all the founding fathers would have taken for granted as being non-negotiable, regarding, in effect, the idea that your home really is your castle. And in fact, in the 18th century, that isn't just something that Ralph Cramden said on the Honeymooners. In the 18th century, James Otis, when arguing against broad powers of search and seizure on the part of the British government, used this phrase and said this is the traditional British understanding, that a person's home is his castle, and that he's to be secure in it against unreasonable searches and seizures. Well, just this week we've just read that the Congress has now gone ahead and approved a broader authority for the president to engage in surveillance of people. So it doesn't even have to go into your home, but wiretapping and surveillance, which had caused such outrage when we discovered it several years ago. We discovered that the New York Times had known about it for a year and hadn't said anything. And some people on the right, I'm sorry to report, have sometimes argued that, you know, we're really getting too worked up about this, that the fact is that the rules initially said that the president, if he wants to engage in wiretapping, he has to go before what's called the FISA, a FISA court, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, and get the permission of a judge, and then go ahead and do the surveillance. And some people on the right have said, well, look, these judges have never once turned a president down, so really, who really cares if he's not going to these judges and he's just doing it on his own? But the answer to that is that at least if you have to go to a judge, that's at least one person who knows what you're up to. And what I strongly suspect is happening is that the president, in my opinion, is using this power not so much to go after terrorism, although perhaps he is at some level, but I frankly think it's to dig up dirt on his political opponents. And that's why he doesn't want to go to the FISA court, because that would never be approved. I think he wants to dig up evidence against his political opponents, which may, I insert a very big may, be part of the explanation why the Democrats have been such pathetic opponents of his. Maybe he's got something on half of them. I have no idea. But all I do know is that this is a road we should not be wanting to travel down. And the fact that the Congress has now rushed to increase the president's power here shows that we're not just dealing with an executive branch run amok. We're dealing with a whole government that has detached itself from traditional restraints.
Mary, thank you very much for your call, and we'll continue to take other calls and continue talking with Thomas E. Woods, Jr. about his book, 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask, continuing just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. Glad to have you with us today as we talk about American history, specifically 33 questions about American history you're not supposed to ask. Some of those questions included, did Martin Luther King Jr. oppose affirmative action? Were the American Indians really environmentalists? What was the biggest unknown scandal of the Clinton years? And was the Wild West really so wild? Those are questions that we can get into as we go along. But let's take some more calls. If you'd like to join in, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's 800-642-1234 as we talk with Thomas E. Woods, Jr. And Ron in Madison is next. Hello, Ron.
In 1620, when the Mayflower arrived in New England, it was full of illegal immigrants because they had no permission from the Native Americans who lived in what we call Massachusetts to come there. And the English Empire back in Europe had authorized those Puritans, Pilgrims, whatever, to move from Holland to Virginia. They had no authority from the Empire to go there either. Mm. That's my basic thing. And so all the people who claim ancestors on the Mayflower, like the Daughters of the American Revolution, would all be illegal immigrants. The second point is that real Americans are people whose ancestors were already here before 1492, and we are recent Americans because our ancestors arrived after 1491. And in all this debate in 2007, it is us recent Americans who keep trying to, or recent Americans like us, some of us, keep trying to tell the real Americans to get out of America and to stay out of America. It is Native Americans from Mexico, from Central America, from other parts of the U.S. or the North and South American continents who really have rights to be here, much more than us European Americans who came in under illegal pretexts. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Ron.
Well, I guess I just have a brief reply to that. Alexander Hamilton raised this issue, and he did it perhaps in a crude way that I myself wouldn't have done. But Hamilton said, if you want to see, if you're interested in an example of a people that was not able to enforce immigration restrictions and, in effect, lost control of its territory, he said, you know, we look at the natives who preceded us here, and he said that should be a salutary warning about the importance of keeping control of one's borders.
Let me ask you about the question about American Indians as environmentalists. Mm. You refer to then-Senator Al Gore back in 1992 in his book Earth and the Balance, citing the 19th-century speech from Chief Seattle, which many people have seen as evidence of Indians' concern for nature. Did you find that to be true, or what did you find?
Well, what I found that in general is that and by the way, I use the term American Indian not to be gratuitously politically incorrect, but because it's actually a more specific term than Native American, because it excludes people from Alaska and Guam and some of these outlying areas. But what I found is that, as with all human beings, they had a mixed record with the environment, and I think sometimes people who have a concern for the environment have been, I think, unfair to the American Indians by sort of portraying them in this heavily sort of stylized manner, you know, that as almost mannequins and not as real people, frankly. I think their views have been caricatured. It's been said that the American Indians believe that every single living thing or non-living thing and all of it is sacred and we wouldn't touch any of it. Well, some of them, frankly, find this insulting. I mean, you know, this is not what we believed. And what I show, as I say, is that, first of all, the Chief Seattle speech that Al Gore quotes is a phony speech. He did give a speech in the 19th century. This is a Pacific Northwest Indian chief, Seattle. He did give a speech in the 19th century. He was saying that we've got our ancestors buried in this land here, so when we sell it to the whites, we want to make sure we retain the right to visit it because it's sacred to us because our ancestors are buried there. So he's making a very specific, limited claim. The land is sacred because our ancestors are here, not because we have a religious kinship with all land everywhere. The version of the speech that Al Gore quotes was invented by a Texas screenwriter in the early 1970s named Ted Perry, who, to his credit, has run around the country trying to tell people he made the speech up. But meanwhile, a children's book was based on the Ted Perry speech, hit number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list. It's completely phony. That's not good. I mean, that's just not the right thing to do. I mean, even if the American Indians believed something I believed, you know, I wouldn't try to make something phony up to support it still further. As I say, their record was mixed. So in some cases, they were very bad stewards of animal species because they believed that some of them believed that if you kill an animal in a hunt, you shouldn't reproach yourself for that because the animal will be reanimated in larger numbers. Well, of course, that's just going to lead to wiping out whole populations. They almost wiped out the white-tailed deer, for example. But what I show is that where they were good in the environment, this is what's most interesting. I mean, I'm not interested in a sort of a Rush Limbaugh, these are savages, I don't want to learn anything from them sort of approach. To the contrary, what I'm trying to show is that they were good on the environment on some things, but what will surprise us is how they were good on the environment, is that oftentimes they employed what we would recognize as property rights to protect the environment. They would say, this family or this clan can hunt in this designated area, and they exclusively could hunt there. And having been granted those exclusive rights, they had an interest in, you know, not killing every single animal there, because then what provision would there be for the future? They had an incentive to preserve stocks of animals for the future, for next year, in order to reproduce. And they also have the power to prevent poachers coming on their territory trying to just wipe out all the animals. So they have the incentive to be good stewards. Or in the Pacific Northwest, they assigned fishing rights, again, to clan and family-based groups, again, so as to protect against, if nobody owns anything, then everybody will just catch all the salmon and there'll be none for next year. But they were careful to preserve stocks for the future because families have the right to fish in particular areas, and they know that next year they're going to need salmon just as much as they do this year. So that gave them the incentive to preserve these stocks, and I show that when the whites took over the salmon in the Pacific Northwest, they completely ignored all these Indian lessons, and you wound up with the tragedy of the commons, where everybody feels like nobody owns the salmon, so everybody better just hurry up and get whatever salmon you can while the getting is good, and you wipe it all out. So they actually do. The Indians do have useful environmental lessons for us, but they're not usually the ones that we wind up getting.
Did the Pilgrims flourish in America thanks to Indian agricultural wisdom? Is another question you pose in the book.
Right. Now, this one I'm actually making a rather limited point, which is that in the 1970s, there was a woman named Lynn Sesse, who was an anthropologist studying New England at that time. And what she found was that when the Pilgrims arrived and they met an Indian they knew as Squanto, He introduced to them this practice whereby, in order to increase crop yield and grow corn better, you would use fish as fertilizer. And so they adopted this practice for a number of years, and they just sort of assumed naturally that this must be, you know, a customary Indian practice. But it turns out that, according to Lynn Sesse in the 1970s, much more likely is that Squanto himself, who had traveled quite a bit, having been a captive, in fact, of Europeans, had probably learned the practice from Europeans, because she found no anthropological evidence indicating that the American Indian tribes used anything for fertilizer, much less fish. And in fact, now the consensus among historians is that she was probably right. Charles Mann has a book called 1491, and he basically agrees that she's probably right. But the reason I point this out is that when she advanced her, wrote this up in scholarly journals and wrote about it in Science magazine in the 70s, instead of people saying, well, isn't this an interesting discovery? Now we understand things better. She was assaulted on all sides. She was a completely apolitical person, but she was assaulted and accused of arguing that the Indians were too stupid to use fertilizer, when her point was that fish as fertilizer is an extremely labor-intensive process, and when you have land in such abundance as the Indians did, it made much more sense to let the land lie fallow than it did to go and catch all these fish and bring all these rotting fish to your land. It just didn't make any sense for them. But she was frankly attacked on sort of politically correct grounds, that she's an enemy of the Indians and she's not an Indian herself, so what right does she have to talk about it? And I'm raising this as an example of, I mean, I don't think we can ignore this. This type of phenomenon does occur in academia, and it's not useful, and it was very unfair to her.
We're talking with Thomas E. Woods, Jr., contributing editor of the American Conservative magazine, the author of 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask. And you, of course, can find out more about his writings at thomasewoods.com. To the phones, to Bob in Darlington, Wisconsin next. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Gee, thanks for taking my call. You know, my wife and I now, we're in our mid-70s, and we both come from the Northern Plains. I come from North Dakota, and Audrey comes from Minnesota. And both our grandparents and our great-grandparents were from Northern Europe. They immigrated. They came to the United States as immigrants. And I think almost to an individual, all these people are, well, they amount to maybe 25 or 30 people I'm talking about then. And they wanted to learn English as fast as they possibly could. And most of them became farmers in North Dakota and Minnesota. And I don't know why they wanted to do this, but then when I was a young lad and I'd visit my grandparents and great-grandparents, and I'd talk to them in English and told them that I sang in the choir and so forth, and they saw me do this, and they thought it was just marvelous and wonderful, and they pushed me, you know, and they just said, "Oh, gee, Bob, that's just wonderful. Are you ever a good boy?" You know, and so forth, and they really promoted the language in that way, and they wanted to learn the new English language, and all of them spoke a foreign language, mainly Norwegian, German, and I think Russian and Polish, so I don't know why they thought this, but maybe your guests can lay a little knowledge on me with that.
In other words, why there was an impetus or a desire to learn English and more or less try to assimilate and become part of the adopted country? Is that the question?
Yeah, very quickly.
I wonder. I mean, I guess it partly depends on the time frame we're talking about, but you know, it could well be that when you have a country that is more or less, I mean, I think the United States more or less has always been reasonably welcoming. I mean, there have been nativist movements throughout American history, but you wouldn't have, if the United States were that unwelcoming, people wouldn't be coming. You know, so I mean, you know, of course there is that. But what I think happened is that, especially earlier in American history, you know, there isn't a much of a social safety net, at least not a government one. I mean, you had fraternal organizations and churches and civic groups that would help you out, but you know, you had to really make it on your own, and it could be something quite terrifying. And in order to do that, well, you'd have to make yourself seem employable to people, and the first, absolutely indispensable characteristic would be that you'd be an English speaker. But I guess it's sort of because there was a kind of sink or swim philosophy. I think, yeah, I mean, certainly if I came here, you're darn right, that's what I'd be doing all day and all night, trying to learn English and do what I could so that I wouldn't wind up failing and then having to return home. But I'm sorry that's such a conventional answer, but that's the one that occurs to me.
Bob, thank you very much for your call and for participating. And if you'd like to join in, all you have to do is give us a call at 263-1890, otherwise toll free at 800-642-1234. Another of the questions that you pose in your book is, was the U.S. Constitution meant to be a living, breathing document that changes with the times?
Yeah, and Jim, this is a very, very common thing to hear the Constitution described in this way. And so I want to make clear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying the Constitution can never be changed. You know, I'm glad we added the 13th Amendment and abolished slavery, for instance. But mm-hmm. The point is, we did that through an amendment. And when Prohibition occurred, we had Prohibition, which, again, I don't support that either, needless to say, but when we had Prohibition, that was also done through an amendment. Now, whereas today, I mean, imagine for some reason the political winds turned in such a way that there was a movement for Prohibition again. I personally don't believe they would bother with a constitutional amendment. They would just come up with some strained constitutional interpretation arguing that they have every right to ban alcohol. Like they would, no one would even think you would need an amendment anymore, and I think that's a dangerous thing, that when you carry out something as extreme as Prohibition, well, you should have to go through the amendment process. You shouldn't just be able to come up with some kind of half-baked theory as to why the Constitution really does permit prohibiting alcohol or whatever the thing is. The point I'm making in the book about this is that we should remember why we fought the revolution against the British. It wasn't just because they were trying to impose some fairly minor taxes on us. It was mainly this, that the British, of course, don't have a written constitution. The British constitution is really a collection of customary practices and traditions, so that you couldn't say, hey, the British government is violating Article 7 of the Constitution, because there is no Article 7. Now, the problem with this was that since there was no fixed document, then the British Constitution pretty much meant whatever the British government said it meant from day to day, and Americans found they could not protect their liberties under such circumstances. If the government gets to say what the Constitution is whatever we say it is, well, you know, obviously that's not a very secure situation. So 4 years, just 4 short years after we signed the peace treaty with the British, in 1787 we had the Constitutional Convention. It's not an accident that Americans wanted to write down their Constitution, write it down so that it can't be subject to this type of British government manipulation, so that this way you could say the Constitution has a fixed meaning, and if the government violates it, we'll be able to point to chapter and verse right here. You're violating this particular text, or you're taking a power that we never gave you. It would have a fixed meaning. So it was precisely because they didn't want to have a living, breathing Constitution that is whatever the judges say it is. That's pretty much what we lived with under the British. We might as well just go back to the British if that's what we want. We wanted to have something that could be changed by the people with the consent of the people, but which on a daily basis would be fixed, because it was thought that that was how you protect the liberties of people, was to have the government be bound by, as Jefferson said, the chains of the Constitution.
When we talk about the Bush presidency, many of his critics will say that it's an imperial presidency, and growing more so every day. If there is an imperial presidency, who is most responsible for such a thing?
Well, I offer in the book an answer that is not going to make anybody happy, because I basically raise a president that I think people on left and right alike view as just having been a great president. That's Teddy Roosevelt, because I think when you look closely at him, he comes to the presidency with a full-fledged philosophy of the presidency that you see, I think, blossoming fully in the current administration. It has germinated for years, and it's really coming to fruition, because his view, the view of Teddy Roosevelt, was that the president, first of all, we should understand that according to the 10th Amendment, the federal government has only the powers that are granted to it, and anything that it's not granted rests with the states. Roosevelt's view was the president has whatever powers are not expressly withheld from him. Well, that's a very, very broad conception of presidential power. Mm-hmm. The president can do anything that's not prohibited. And since the president, moreover, is the exclusive voice of the American people, he says the American people all vote for me. They don't all vote for the senator from Massachusetts, for instance. They all vote for president, though. So I am their representative, and it's my job to carry out their will. Well, every demagogue has spoken that way. I am the exclusive representative of the people, and if I need to run roughshod over Congress, well, that's my job. It's part of my job to implement the people's will. And it's worth noting that government by executive order, whereby the president just issues some order without congressional consent, that really came into being under Theodore Roosevelt. I mean, up till Theodore Roosevelt, if you look at the number of executive orders issued, it's very, very few. Like Grover Cleveland in his second term issued 71, McKinley about 51. Previous presidents had issued maybe 3 or even 0. Under Theodore Roosevelt, we got 1,006 executive orders, and that was his governing style, that if the Congress is going to hem and haw, then he's going to implement the thing anyway. And in fact, and if people are going to protest about the way the Filipinos are being treated under the U.S. occupation there, not only does Theodore Roosevelt not care, he's going to give medals and awards to the people responsible. This is, I think, more or less what we have now, but people like Teddy Roosevelt because he was charismatic and he had an interesting personality and he had that big smile and he was a horseback rider and he was just such a fascinating person. People sort of overlook the fact that he's laying the groundwork for, I think, a very, very difficult to control office once he leaves.
Our guest is Thomas E. Woods, Jr. He is the New York Times bestselling author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, and his new book is 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask. It's published by Crown Forum, and you can get more information about his writings and his thoughts at thomasewoods.com. We'll continue to take your calls and talk with Roy and John in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you with us today. Hope that you're enjoying the program. And if you'd like to participate, all you have to do is give us a call. In Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Thomas E. Woods, Jr. is a contributing editor of the American Conservative magazine. He lives in Alabama, and he's a fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. I should ask you who Ludwig von Mises was.
I'll give you this just a 30-second overview. He was an economist who lived in Austria, and but because he basically taught all the values of classical liberalism, basically a free economy, peace, toleration, all the principles we associate with old liberalism. He was persecuted by the Nazis. His library was burned. He had to flee. He eventually came to the United States in 1940, where he wrote some of the greatest works on economics ever written. But his was a lonely voice in fascist Europe. So he's an extraordinary figure, and it's just an honor to be associated with his name.
Let's go back to the phones to Roy in Bayside next. Hello, Roy.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, thank you. I praise this program for having a guest who's a conservative who opposes the Iraq war. There's almost a total national news blackout on such people. Briefly, so many national and local commercial radio and TV talk show hosts and newspaper columnists always say daily that opposing the Iraq war is automatically a liberal, left-wing, or Democrat viewpoint, and supporting the Iraq war is automatically a conservative, right-wing, or Republican viewpoint. I'd like your guest's comment.
It's almost like I planted this call. I love it so much. that's so important, and you're right. I think the media, present company accepted, you understand, I think wants to keep things simple for us, so that on TV, supporter of the war is always a so-called conservative, and an opponent is always a liberal. But that's not particularly accurate, for one thing. I mean, let's consider that there are, it seems to me, at least a lot of Democrats, whether they're liberals or not is another matter, but like Hillary Clinton was all in favor of the war, and and plus the New York Times and the Washington Post were in favor of it, and they're supposedly liberal papers, so I'm not so sure that these terms are helpful. And when you look at some of the most vicious opponents of it, a lot of them are conservatives. Pat Buchanan, Paul Craig Roberts, who was assistant Treasury Secretary under Reagan, has been more anti-Bush than anybody I have seen, and the list just goes on. And then, of course, there is the candidate everybody wants to ignore among the Republicans, Congressman Ron Paul. He says, I've been against this war for years before it started, ever since in the late 90s the neoconservative Project for a New American Century was planning, in effect wanted an invasion of Iraq and been calling for it for years. He was against it even then. So there is, and Ron Paul is appealing to a tradition among conservatives of being skeptical of war. I mean, if conservatives are going to say with a straight face, you know, well, government fails all the time, and it can't do this, and it can't do that, you can't be taken very seriously if you then turn around and say, however, government can totally transform the political culture of the Middle East if we just give it enough money. Well, where's the consistency in that? And one of these days, I'm going to write an article, possibly for the American Conservative, called Three Anti-Militarists, to show that, in fact, the three intellectuals who were arguably the most influential, according to George Nash's book on American conservatism, the three most intellectual traditional conservatives, most influential intellectuals after World War II were Russell Kirk, Richard Weaver, and Robert Nisbet. And every one of them was skeptical of the use of military force, every one of them. Richard Weaver wrote a beautiful essay against total war and against the atomic bombings of Japan. Russell Kirk was against the military draft. In fact, Russell Kirk is the godfather of modern conservatism. And did you realize that in the early 1990s, after the Persian Gulf War, the first Persian Gulf War, Russell Kirk wrote in a private letter that has since been made public that, in his view, George H.W. Bush should be strung up on the White House lawn as a war criminal. There is a lot more potential overlap and room for collaboration among people on left and right in this matter than I think anybody realizes. And there's a great organization, I have no connection to it other than I am sympathetic to it, called the Anti-War League. Do a Google search for Anti-War League, where they're just trying to bring people together. You know what, we disagree on, you know, a lot of political questions, but we do agree that you probably should try to avoid killing hundreds of thousands of people without a good reason. You know, just if we can agree on that basic thing, then we can cooperate with each other.
Roy, thank you so much for bringing that up. And let's go to John next in Milwaukee. John, what's on your mind?
Hi, I had a constitutional question. I had heard, and I don't know if it's true or not, but what I had heard was that in the U.S. Constitution, there's a provision that says the U.S. president and vice president can't be from the same state. And then what I had also heard was that Vice President Cheney and President Bush both lived in Texas. in that the day before President Bush selected Dick Cheney as his running mate, that Dick Cheney changed his voting registration to Wyoming. And if this is true, that there is a constitutional provision for this, that we don't want candidates from the same state or running mates from the same state, why would we, as a nation, or why would the court system allow them to skirt a constitutional requirement like this if it is true?
Okay. I'm just so taken aback by this because I'd never heard that claim before, and if it's the case that this is something I just don't know about, then I apologize.
Is it that you don't know that they can't be from
right,
the same state?
I'm doing a search for vice president and vice in the text of the Constitution. I don't see any provision that...
I did do an interview with the author of the new book about Dick Cheney, and in there he does say that that is exactly what happened as far as changing registration from Texas
uh-huh. yeah,
to
and,
Cheyenne,
as a matter
Wyoming.
Fact, yes, it's in the 12th Amendment. Yeah, one of whom at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. Okay.
So they did that to avoid that kind of question, I think.
Well, gosh, I mean, I'm embarrassed that I didn't even realize this. So no wonder they're getting away with it. Even I don't know this stuff. Yeah, well, I mean, it doesn't surprise. I mean, that to me seems like the least of some of the things that have gone on in this administration. So, that doesn't surprise me. But you know how they can get away with it, or what? You know, they get away with it if people aren't paying attention. As I say, I'm embarrassed to say that I'm one of them.
John, thank you so much for pointing that out. And we do have lines open if you have comments and questions about the things that we're talking about today. Thomas E. Woods, Jr. is the author of 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask. Here's the American history that nobody knows, everything you won't learn from politically correct history books and professors. For instance, have you ever wondered, did the Founding Fathers support immigration? Was the Wild West really so wild? Did capitalism cause the Great Depression? Did Martin Luther King Jr. oppose affirmative action? And as a question we talked about, were states' rights just code words for slavery and oppression? And Thomas E. Woods, Jr. has been forthcoming and somewhat astonishing at times, and we appreciate your candidness and your thoughts. Let's go to another question, a provocative one. Indicates that there was a larger scandal in the Clinton White House than the relationship between he and Monica Lewinsky. Is that true?
Yes. Well, what I'm arguing here is that I think the Clinton foreign policy got more of a pass from people than it deserved to. And I forget how many years ago exactly it was, but it was after Bill Clinton left office. And he was interviewed by Amy Goodman of Democracy Now.
Mm-hmm.
And he was probably sort of expecting the usual kind of softball questions that ex-presidents are accustomed to. And instead, she just condemned him the whole time. They condemned him for this and that and his foreign policy, and he just couldn't believe he was being spoken to this way. Don't you know I'm the ex-emperor? You don't speak to me this way. And so in a way, that's the kind of posture that I'm taking here. And the specific scandal I'm talking about involves the intervention in the Balkans, particularly from 1993 to 1995, in which Clinton was simply carrying on the policy of his predecessor, So he was very anxious to support we're talking about the former Yugoslavia.
Okay.
He's very anxious to support the cause of the Bosnian Muslims. And it's very understandable because there were a great many atrocities perpetrated by the Bosnian Serbs. Nobody denies that. But there were atrocities on all sides, not all of which got equal press attention. But what happened was that Clinton was so anxious to support the side of the Bosnian Muslims that he would look the other way when they would violate ceasefire agreements that were very fragile. In fact, at one point, and not only did he then support bombing Bosnian Serb positions, but he even favored, as a way of fighting the Bosnian Serbs, actually transporting in a foreign Islamic element from the Middle East into the region, which then never, after the conflict was over, then disappeared into Bosnian society and did not go home. And the problem now is that, according to intelligence officials in Greece and elsewhere in Europe, is that whereas before you didn't have a foreign sort of jihadist kind of element in Bosnia, the Bosnian Muslims were known for being very moderate, politically moderate, religiously moderate. But now, all of a sudden, because of this, you do have this kind of disruptive, violence-prone group that has now ensconced itself in Bosnia, such that even the Washington Post has acknowledged that this was a devil's bargain that now is really coming home to roost. And I'm suggesting that, because my view typically is I favor non-intervention in general, and I think this is an example of the overall wisdom of that. And it's worth noting, by the way, that under George Bush, the father, the Portuguese government had actually worked out a fairly satisfactory resolution among the parties in Bosnia of a kind of ethnic canton solution, which is exactly what they ended up getting after all the fighting anyway. But it was the U.S. administration under George Bush that urged Izet Begovic, who is the president of Bosnia, not to accept this, that he should hold out and try to get a total unified Bosnian state and not go for this ethnic canton solution, but that they ended up going with anyway. You know, the war might not have been necessary. As I don't normally agree with Abe Rosenthal, but he wrote in the New York Times that if we had just gone along, been willing to go along with this settlement in 1992, we wouldn't have had this problem.
Let's go to the phones again to Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Hello, Dave. What's on your mind?
Hi. Good morning. Thank you. Well, I wanted to ask your guest about the Constitution and God. You know, we're given a lot of lines by the right about how our country was founded for the Christian faith and we're supposed to be a Christian nation. And, you know, George Washington said, the United States is in no sense founded upon the Christian doctrine. Thomas Jefferson said, it does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. And I wanted to get your guests' thoughts on that.
All right.
Okay, this is a good question about church and state and the religious nature of the government or non-religious nature. My basic answer to this is that somebody like Thomas Jefferson, his view was that the federal government exists for certain limited utilitarian purposes. The federal government is not there to make philosophical determinations about substantial goods, to tell you how you should live your life, what religion, if any, you should subscribe to. That's not the role of the federal government. The federal government has a very limited role, primarily dealing with foreign policy and national defense. So Jefferson's view was that most of these issues need to be decided on by regular people living in their own neighborhoods. I mean, toward the end of his life, in fact, Jefferson favored having devolving power down to the level of a ward, which is really just a part of a city, and there neighbors and just ordinary people would make decisions about education and all these matters like this. And so Jefferson also said at one point that the federal government has no authority over matters of religion. He said, insofar as anyone has authority over this, it rests with the states. That was his view. So it almost doesn't matter what the federal government has to say. Jefferson's view was, even though I myself may hold unorthodox religious views, let a hundred flowers bloom and let people living in their own neighborhoods decide for themselves if they want to have a nativity scene on the town hall property or not. We're not going to have a one-size-fits-all approach to that because then nobody will be happy.
Dave, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. Let's get Jay in New Auburn into the conversation. Jay, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, guys. Say, I'm not sure I got I understand the theme of the show exactly. I just tuned in, but if I understand it, just a couple of questions that I have that really I've never had answered or certainly weren't taught in school were dealing with what I would consider a genocide of the indigenous peoples of this nation, and also how many natives were held as slaves during different periods in time. I'm assuming the mid-20s or 1820s, 30s, 40s during that period, and what light you might shed on that those issues.
Okay. Well, there is much more robust debate about this now than there was years ago. I agree with that. The famous text that really gets into the nuts and bolts of this, from the point of view that you know the Europeans really were guilty of terrible crimes, is a book by Francis Jennings called very provocatively "The Invasion of America." But then that's been countered by a book by a gentleman named Alden Vaughn from University of Oklahoma Press, called New England Frontier, Puritans and Indians, 1620 to 1675. So those are sort of the dueling texts in this. And then in terms of the, I believe the guest is referring to the relocation, the movement of some of the southeastern tribes out to so-called Indian territory, Oklahoma, and particularly the Cherokees on the Trail of Tears in the 1830s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, a classic example of of the approach that Andrew Jackson took. He was, by and large, he was a limited government guy, but when push came to shove, he would typically favor the federal government over the states. So when South Carolina wanted to nullify the tariffs because they thought they were unconstitutional tariffs, Jackson was prepared to use force against them. And so likewise, when the Cherokees in Georgia said we should have our own law in Georgia, and the white man's law shouldn't be able to reach us on our territory. Well, again, Jackson can't imagine there being two jurisdictions. He can't imagine that. That's just insubordination. There can only be one jurisdiction. The idea that you could live in Georgia and not really live in Georgia at the same time. So in the same way that he crushes resistance to the federal government, he crushes resistance to Georgia, and demands that these people be relocated. So it's a terrible story in American history. But if it's any consolation to the caller, this is all over American history textbooks now. I can testify from firsthand experience with them.
Jay, thank you very much for your call. And I'm sorry that we can't get to more callers, but we are running out of time. I just wanted to note that the Honorable Ron Paul, who's gotten a lot of attention in the debates among Republican presidential candidates, says of this book, Tom Woods, one of the libertarian movement's brightest and most prolific scholars, demolishes the historical myths that mislead too many Americans into supporting big government. I strongly recommend Woods' work. High praise, I suspect.
I'm quite thrilled, Jim, and thanks so much. I mean, this is I wasn't quite sure what to expect coming on here, but it was extremely pleasant, and I hope people enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for being with us. Thomas E. Woods, Jr., contributing editor of the American Conservative magazine and the author of 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask. Our thanks to Martinez White for on-air production. I'm Jim Packard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.